STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my dear friends, and welcome to Stand to Reason. If you detect a little kind of frog in my voice, it's because I'm struggling with a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a cold, maybe it is, but upper respiratory, this and that. So you'll just have to put up with it. I'll have to put up with it today. Regardless, I am happy to be with you and looking forward to chatting with you here on our program on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. And, of course, you're welcome to call in during our live show, which is now for me, but not maybe when you're listening. What's Live? 4 to 7 on Tuesday afternoons, Los Angeles time. The number is 855-243-9975. 855-243-9975. If you're outside the U.S., and sometimes folks call from different parts of the globe, 562 is the area code. 424-8229. Be sure to dial the international code for the U.S. of A. I think that's a 1. In any event, 562-424-8229 is the number. You know, I have a very strange thing that I want to relate to you that has to do with me having a cold right now. And this doesn't happen very often. I actually don't hardly ever get sick. And every once in a while, I get a scratchy voice, and I take one of those Zicam things. In fact, I think last week, I was feeling a little bit scratchy right towards the end of the show, and I take those Zicam things, and it generally knocks it out amazingly. I don't even know what that stuff is, some kind of vitamin or mineral or something, but it does a good job in putting it down, and I wake up the next morning, and I'm pretty much back to normal. This thing has lasted a little bit longer, enough to cause a certain effect that happens with me on occasion. And again, I don't know why this happens, and I don't even know what to make of it. But and there is something about me feeling the feelings of a cold, scratchy throat, sniffles, something about that, that in a certain sense kind of transports me back to when I was a teenager, like in high school or early college, and I think about my girlfriend. I mean, it's all kind of right there. Did you ever have a circumstance when you listen to an old tune or maybe smell a fragrance that you identified in the past with something very particular, and you are in a moment, and just for a moment, kind of transported back to that time? You kind of feel like you're almost there. Well, that's what happens on occasion when I get this cold face feeling and I'm transported, not for a moment, but for 2 or 3 days, I have this certain feeling about me that feels kind of good because I'm emotionally in touch with when I was in high school. What does that mean? Go figure. I don't know, but I like it. And what does that have to do with Stand to Reason, apologetics, theology? Absolutely nothing. But I just thought I'd share that. Maybe somebody else has a similar kind of thing, but it just gives me a kind of a cozy feeling. I can nestle in and relax and feel a certain well-being that I don't usually participate in because I'm carried back. What is that? I don't know. I do have something else to share with you that is much more grave, and it was actually a startling encounter I had a couple of days ago. I was on my way down to San Diego, speak at an event. I stopped in at my local community Starbucks so I could take my brew on the road, and ran into somebody that I knew, a woman who's a single mom. And she, I recognized her and said hi. I didn't know her that well, but I knew her because her daughter used to come along with her to our home and play with my daughter, my youngest, and they'd carry on. And I'm just going to call that daughter Courtney for the sake of discussion here. But her daughter wasn't with her. Instead, there was a young a boy that was sitting at the outside table with her. And so when I said hi, and then I greeted the young lad, and I said, hi, I don't think we've met before. And he said, yes, we have. I said, really? What's your name? And he said, Kenny. I said, Kenny, I do not think we've met before. He said, yes, we have, but I wasn't called Kenny then. And when he said that, a little light began to go on in the back of my head, and I said, well, what did I call you before when I met you last time? And he said, Courtney. This was the little girl. Still is the little girl. But she doesn't look like a little girl. She looks like a little boy. Now, I don't know how old she is. I would say 7 or 8. Yeah, prepubescent. A young girl, like my daughter. And there she was. And I have to say, when she told me that she used to be called Courtney, she looked at me sheepishly. And I looked at her mom, because I, even though the light has gone on in my head a little bit, it still hadn't fully dawned on me, and I was caught by surprise. I looked at her mom, and her mom smiled and nodded sheepishly, too. That is, they weren't entirely comfortable with this, or they realized that I wouldn't be, or maybe it seemed a little bit odd. Now, this wasn't the kind of relationship that I would have lingered long with anyway, and I was on my way out, and I had a long drive down to San Diego, and so I needed to say goodbye. And I hope it didn't seem like I got that piece of news, and then I'm check, please, I'm out of here. That wasn't the way I intended it to come across. I needed to move on, but at the same time, I didn't want to say anything like positive, like, wow, that's nice, Kenny. Gee, good for you. Or, you know, what do you say in a situation like that? I didn't say anything, as it turned out. I just nodded in acknowledgement and then said to her mom, to Courtney's mom, you know, I'm on my way out. I've got to get on the road. I got a trip to make. I just wanted to say hi. I walked by. I saw you. I just wanted to greet you. Have a good day. And off I was. Off I went. But I was very grieved about this. And as I drove, and it's like a situation for many of you when you have an encounter with something that is significant and you look back on it and you think, God, I wish I would have done I wish I would have said or would have, could have, should have kind of thing. And that's what I was doing. And it occurred to me, I don't want to be mean, obviously. Please, obviously. At the same time, it strikes me as just as hostile in a deep sense if I would have smiled and acted like it was a fine little thing that she's now become a boy or is dressing like and looks like a boy, because that's not fine. That's called gender confusion. And so I got caught. I certainly wasn't going to nod, smile and that kind of thing. But if I had done that, I think that would have been cruel in the sense that, morally speaking, to encourage or act like something is fine that is seriously wrong, I think that's cruel. That's wrong. Maybe is a better word for it. Even though, had I done something like given the nod and all of that, both of them would have felt better in the moment. I would not have been doing them any favors. But as I drove down to San Diego and I thought about it and prayed about it and prayed for that family, the single mom and that young lady who was so confused and being grieved in my heart, I thought, you know, I wish I would have said, I'm sorry to hear that. and maybe added, "Honey, you will always be Courtney to me." Not in a mean way, but reaffirming reality for that young lady. I have a feeling that I don't know, but I think the rank and file, especially the politically correct crowd, are going to fall over themselves to be supportive of this kind of thing. Mom is supportive of the true Kenny. As far as I'm concerned, one's true gender is the gender that was revealed when the doctor swatted your bottom and said, "It's a boy, it's a girl." The announcement is made to the parents. Now, some people call that pejoratively gender assignment. I read an article about that. Can you believe that doctors are doing this without the parents' consent? Gender assignment? No, he's not assigning gender. He's acknowledging the gender that's already there. As if gender is just this thing that is a matter of whim and all you do is flip the coin. No. Your body tells you what gender you are. If your mind doesn't match it, then something's wrong. It's confusion. And as long as there's going to be a mismatch between the body and the mind, there is always going to be confusion. Now, even if, as an adult, the one confused gets an operation, that is not going to change the confusion. All it does is alter the body. Ultimately, it doesn't even change the body. There is no such thing as a sex change operation. Your sex cannot be changed. All you can do is mutilate yourself. That's all you can do. Now, please don't read this, though many will respond this way, as my grotesque insensitivity to people who are struggling with this. I don't see it that way. I think what this woman and this child really need is someone to speak truthfully and directly to them with a gracious heart. Truth and love, but certainly the truth. It is not only the truth, but it is not less than the truth. It's truth and love that this isn't good. Now, I have in front of me an article. It was actually written by Marvin Alasky in World Magazine beginning of this month, October, that addresses a broader question but entails this issue of gender confusion. And it is a question about the legitimacy of treating the gender confused, transgendered, if you will, as if their mind is right and their body is wrong, and then giving them an operation to bring the two in alignment. And as I just pointed out, that is impossible because the body can never be changed to a different sex. In any event, in this article, Marvin Alasky writes about Paul McHugh, who is the former psychiatrist-in-chief at Johns Hopkins Hospital, wrote a piece at the Wall Street Journal, headline, "Transgender Surgery Isn't the Solution. A Drastic Physical Change Doesn't Address Underlying Psychosocial Troubles." And this is the point that I'm making here. What's really significant in this particular case is the role that Paul McHugh actually plays in this broader issue. His role at Johns Hopkins, apparently Johns Hopkins was one of the first medical centers in the 60s to do sex reassignment surgery, their euphemism. And what ended up happening, as they were involved in this for many, many years, obviously, is that they later compared the psychosocial adjustment of patients who had the surgery with those who had the same confusion but who did not have the surgery. And they found out that the former were no better off than the latter. And as a result, since doing the surgery did not seem to help anybody in terms of their psychosocial adjustment. They quit doing those surgeries at Johns Hopkins. And the reason was very straightforward, in the words of Marvin Olasky: why amputate normal organs if the results aren't beneficial? Now, this is, I want to say, horse sense, because it seems like it is so basic. Common sense will do. It's so basic that that as one person, one wag put it, these ideas must have come from intellectuals because no ordinary person would be that stupid. Of course this makes sense. Why amputate normal organs if the results aren't beneficial? The article, though, points out something else that I did not know. And that is, let me see here. And here Olasky is citing McHugh in his article. Let me just read the paragraph. McHugh wrote acidly of those who hurt transgender claimants, quote, by treating their confusions as a right in need of defending rather than as a mental disorder that deserves understanding, treatment, and prevention, close quote. He also criticized misguided doctors, that's McHugh's terminology, who administer, quote, puberty-delaying hormones to render later sex change surgeries less onerous, even though the drugs stunt the children's growth and risk causing sterility. Now, here's the payoff, though, for me. Given, and this, again, this is Olasky quoting McHugh in his Wall Street Journal article, given that close to 80% of such children would abandon their confusion and grow naturally into adult life if untreated, these medical interventions come close to child abuse, close quote. I had never heard that before. In the case of childhood gender confusion, 80% of the children figure it out and therefore abandon their confusion and grow naturally into adult life with an identity, mental identity, that matches their physical body, which is called health on this issue, and is what we want. But what happens when this particular confusion is encouraged, as it was in the case of the woman that I encountered the other day? Well, it's possible those children then might get early sex reassignment surgery, and then it's done with. What these kids need is love and encouragement and direction and boundaries, not acquiescence, political correctness, encouragement. In fact, Olasky writes, McHugh noted that persons who believe they need transgendering are like others who suffer from anorexia or bulimia nervosa and view themselves as blobs even while they become emaciated. Such individuals have disordered self-perception, and so do those who are male but think they are female or vice versa. Apparently, according to McHugh, when children who reported transgender feelings were tracked without medical or surgical treatment at both Vanderbilt University and London's Portman Clinic, 70 to 80% of them spontaneously lost those feelings. So that's just another citation in addition to the one that I mentioned from McHugh's article. So anyway, that was a wake-up call for me. It just caught me by surprise in that instance, but it doesn't surprise me. It does not surprise me that people who deviate from an understanding of the world the way God made it, even in its brokenness, even in its confusion, even its distortions, when people start believing that the distortion, well, let me back up and put it this way. When people deviate from letting God help them see the world the way it really ought to be, and this, as I said, is horse sense in a lot of circumstances, they end up believing all kinds of foolishness and silliness and then pattern their life after that, and nothing good comes of it. You sow to the wind, you reap the whirlwind, the prophet said. And I hope in this circumstance and in many others, people will come to their senses and embrace reality instead of nonsense. All right, let's go to calls in just a few minutes. We need a break. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And going to calls right now, and understandably, this one's anonymous and a tough call right off the bat. Let's just call you John. Is that all right?
That works for me, Greg.
It works for you. Good. John, thank you. John Anonymous, thank you. Thanks for your call. How can I help you?
Thanks for calling, Greg.
Sure.
I just want to first say thank you so much for your ministry. It's been a great help to me.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Anyways, I'm calling because I am a law enforcement officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a Christian, but part of my responsibility as a law enforcement officer has always been to understand that it isn't my job to make the rules, just to enforce them.
Uh-huh.
And there may be some circumstances where I don't necessarily agree with all the laws that the government passes,
mm-hmm.
but if we had police that were just disregarding laws because they didn't agree with them, the whole system wouldn't work and break down.
I understand. That would be the rule of law would break down, right?
Exactly. So there have been cases in the past where I might not necessarily agree with laws that the government passed, or my Christian convictions might even sometimes be opposed to those laws,
mm-hmm.
but I've always just kind of approached it from, well, as a cop, my responsibility is to uphold the law as it is,
mm-hmm.
and then as a private citizen, to try to elect new politicians who will change those laws.
Right.
But I know last week I was listening to the podcast, and you were talking about how in Houston now some pastors have been ordered to hand over their sermons to be examined for hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking. I don't think we're here yet, but I do definitely see it coming down the road. And if the day ever came that laws were passed where I was then ordered to arrest a pastor for speaking out against homosexuality, what would my moral obligation as a Christian mm-hmm. be?
Well, I'll give you my response the way I understand it now and some of the reasons. I am going to be vigilant, though, about reflecting more on this particular question. But the illustration that you offered me regarding the Houston thing, I think it would be your responsibility to do your duty as a police officer and arrest the pastors. And part of the reason has to do with actually there's a number of things going on. Now, I think there's a – I'm going to qualify this in a moment, but let's just take it at face value right now. In our system, everybody still gets their day in court. Your job is to do the role that you do, participate and play the role that you do as a part of a civil society – in which God has instituted authorities to mitigate the impact of evil in our world. And one of those authorities is the government. And it is certainly is not the case that all governments are fully good, obviously, but that doesn't change our responsibility in general to government. And as if we oppose authority, the authorities that God has set up, and that is one, the government. And I think I'm reflecting now on Romans towards the end of the book, Romans 13 or 12 or thereabouts. I was just reading this the other day. Then we're opposing the government or the authority that God himself has set up. And there, the principle of the rule of law that is for everyone's protection begins to break down, as you pointed out, rightly, if individuals try to be their own judge and jury on individual circumstances that they're facing here. And so I think in these kinds of circumstances we're facing right now, it is appropriate for you to do your job in arresting those for whom there's a warrant if the government thinks there's probable cause that they broke the law. Now, in our system, they get their day in court. And so it isn't like your act of fulfilling your responsibilities is going to lead to the inexorably to the condemnation of an innocent person. In my view, that responsibility is not on your head. Okay?
Okay.
So generally speaking, I think everybody should just play by the rules. And if we don't, it's going to cause more chaos and difficulty and trouble and ultimately evil, I think, in the world. Now, are there limits to that? And the answer that I'll give is yes, there are limits to that. It is not inconsistent with your Christian convictions to carry out the responsibilities of a law enforcement officer with duly passed laws. Okay?
Okay.
There isn't a conflict just with arresting people. Now, I think, and we know that there are governments that have been like this and are still today, where what the police in that circumstance are being used to do turn out to be systematically unjust and deeply immoral violations of sound, how would I call it here? I guess I said immoral violations of sound morality. That's a redundancy, but you get what I'm talking about here.
There are sometimes
where there's a line in where you cross a line. So I'm thinking like the brown shirts, the Gestapo, all of that kind of stuff. These, and I'm reading through Bonhoeffer now by Metaxas and recounting the things that happened there. And certainly a line was crossed there, where the laws themselves were so thoroughly and completely unjust that it seems to me participating in them would have compromised a person's Christian commitment. And when that line is crossed, I think this is a little bit harder to decide. We can see clear case examples on either side. Sometimes the dividing line is a fine line. We're not anywhere close to that line right now, so I don't think that you are in jeopardy of crossing it at the moment, but it's good given the position of authority that you're in, that you're asking yourself these kinds of questions, because certainly in principle, it might get to the point where upholding your responsibilities as an officer forces you into deeply immoral conduct. And when you are obliged to do something immoral, arresting somebody is not immoral, But there are other things that could be around, especially if you knew, for example, that if you arrested this person, then this is signing their death warrant, and the death warrant of an innocent person. Well, then I think that's, and this happened in the Third Reich, that would be an example of crossing the line.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, we're nowhere near that now. And I think that we are responsible to the government as it stands right now to carry out and execute the laws that we have. We have a legal process. We have the rule of law that is largely intact in our country. And the longer it stays intact, the better it will be for everyone, even though sometimes people don't. They don't get justice.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually for someone else to ultimately decide. But I think you're right to be asking these questions.
Okay. Well, and definitely. And I remember going through the academy. They constantly put forward all kinds of hypothetical scenarios because, like you said, at the Nuremberg trials, the Nazis' argument was we were just following orders.
Yes.
But
adequate. I mean, it gets mm-hmm. to a point where that justification is not adequate. Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a difficult line, but I definitely see that this particular thing could be happening in the next few years, unfortunately.
Right. And
it's not a position I want to be in, but I very well may be. So.
Yeah, you're right. And let me give you a couple more thoughts here. That one of them is that when Christians encounter persecution, they are free to flee. That means you don't have to stand and take it if you can get out of it. Remember what Jesus said, I think, in Matthew 10, that when he's sending out the disciples in the short-term missionary journey, and he says, look, if you get persecuted in this city, what? Flee to the next. When mm-hmm. Paul experienced persecution early on in his Christian life in Damascus, they let him down over the wall secretly in a basket at night, so he could get away unharmed. And there were a number of cases, as I recall, in Asia Minor, where he got into conflict and he was whisked away to avoid the trouble. So fleeing is certainly a legitimate option. And if someone is in a compromised situation, whether you're told to exercise your duty in an illicit way, or if other Christians are being persecuted, you don't have to stand and take it. You can flee, but mm-hmm. if you choose to, in a sense, assert your conscience as a Christian, and you are arrested, the pattern in the New Testament is that the Christians took their licking.
All right.
They were willing to suffer for conscience' sake. All right?
Yeah. Yes.
All right, Anonymous John, I appreciate your call.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Greg.
Yeah, and I hope it never gets to that point for you or any of us.
I am praying that it doesn't.
Yeah, but. Well, God bless you. Thank you for your service to your community.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Now, I'm just thinking right now, in 20 years of radio, no, 25 years, almost starting my 26th year of radio, would I have ever anticipated that particular call? Probably not for 20-some years, but in the last couple of years, this becomes the kind of call that might come up, and it just did. Does that tell you anything about the direction our culture is going? When we are involved as we are right now in working out our vision for the next 10 years, from 2015 to 2025, one word that keeps coming up in our conversations that we need to make sure has a place in this vision is the word courage. Because we understand that in order to stand for Christ in our culture, it takes more than the right information. It takes more than the right answers. It takes more than the right tactics. It takes courage. And it's always taken a certain kind of courage, hasn't it? Because nobody likes being shunned or being persona non grata in your community of friends, because we all want to be liked. This is a human tendency. Nothing wrong with that. The problem is when our desire to have people think well of us becomes the thing that drives our conscience and our actions. The writer of Proverbs says, the fear of man brings a snare, but the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And sometimes we get our fears mixed up. And in the past, we've had to suffer, some of us, disdain and contempt in actions, in responses to us. All right, so that's not fun, but didn't hurt that much. The writer of Hebrews says, you have not resisted sin to the point of shedding blood, but things are changing. Times are changing. That was then, this is now. And it is, more is on stake, more is at stake for Christians nowadays in being faithful than just being called names. Sure, certainly the threat of being called a name is causing some professing followers of Christ to take cover, and that's unfortunate that they can't suffer the slings and arrows of name calling. That's pretty weak. That's pretty sad. But there's more on the table now, isn't there? People are getting sued. People are losing their jobs. People are going to jail, even in this country, for their convictions. And this is why we need courage. All of us do. In this world, you have tribulation, Jesus said, but be of good, what? Courage, for I have overcome the world. In Matthew 10, I've said this many times, I'm going to keep on saying it. Jesus says three times, do not fear them, do not fear them, do not fear them. Peter says in our famous passage of defending the faith, 1 Peter chapter 3, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed, and do not fear them. Do not fear their intimidation. Do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that's within you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Do good, Peter says. And if you do good, hey, who's going to bother you? Who's going to harm you? You're doing good. But even if you should suffer for doing good, then don't fear them. Instead, sanctify Christ as Lord. Be true to Christ as Lord. Make your defense. Give an answer. So we know it's coming. It's right there in black and white. I never could understand, really, as I reflected more and more on what the New Testament taught, why in the minds of so many Christians there would be this what I think is kind of an inappropriate triumphalism. Oh, everything's going to be wonderful if you become a Christian. I became a follower of Christ in the Jesus movement, and there was a lot of that stuff going on. Become a Christian, you get peace and joy, and God will take away your troubles and return your girlfriend and get your kid off drugs and repair your marriage. Well, there are no such promises. Well, peace and joy, yes, but the peace and joy that God promises, I do not think are the kinds of peace and joy that most people think of when they're talking about that. No hardship, difficulty, suffering. That's more standard. And in the midst of that, an ability to persevere by the grace of God and a joy that goes beyond the circumstances. But that's a whole different kind of thing than a lot of people are talking about. Anyway, you're listening to Stand to Reason. I'll be back after this.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Greg Kokel, your host, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Tuesday afternoon, now for our live show from 4 until 7 p.m. Los Angeles time. So if you're listening by delay on a Sunday on your radio station in your community, or you are maybe listening on a podcast, of course, love to talk to you sometime, but you have to call during the live show. That number is 855-243-9975. All right. Okay, let's go to Matt in New Mexico. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, Greg. I run a couple of pro-life pages on Facebook and Twitter and whatever.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, so on the pages, there have been some very heated debates over a wide range of topics.
Right.
You know, from the use of graphic images to how to deal with post-abortive women and men,
right,
et cetera, the whole gamut. But I have not seen an issue so divisive as the issue of vaccination and being pro-life. Yes.
Huh.
I have lost friends over this issue.
I want to hear the rest of your story, but I am curious, why is it that the issue of vaccination, I know there's a pro-life angle to this, but why is it have so much gravity that someone would separate from you as a brother in Christ because you differed on this particular point? Doesn't that strike you as a little bit heavy-handed?
Yeah, it does. Yes. The main moral issue is that there are a lot of speculation as to whether or not the actual vaccine cocktail themselves,
right,
contain aborted fetuses. Whether or not the vaccines themselves actually contain aborted fetuses. There's articles from a lot of pro-life sites that make that very claim.
Okay, when you say aborted fetuses, you mean that the debris from an aborted fetus is used in the production of the vaccine. Is that correct?
That is what they are saying.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Okay.
And they are saying that aborted fetal cells continue to remain in the vaccine when it is injected.
Okay, and how is it that makes participation or the use of the vaccine immoral?
It's because the production of the vaccine happened because of the use of aborted fetal cells.
Okay,
that's the main dividing. And you know, there's also the claims of toxins and poisons and heavy metals. All of
yeah. Let's set stuff, the but, those are health. Let's just set those concerns aside for the moment, because that's a little different kind of argument. I want to go directly to this particular question, and I can understand, especially for pro-lifers, how this can be emotionally charged, okay? But mm-hmm. I have dealt with questions like this before, and I might be missing something, but let me just offer you a little anecdote that hope that might put this in a different light. When I was in my 20s, I went to Michigan State University, and my high school sweetheart was there as well, and she was a medical technology program at MSU. And mm-hmm. so as a result, it's a medical program, and she would do lab work in a basement of one of the buildings. It was a human necropsy lab. Do you know what that is? That means when you walk into the Bay Area, there's a lot of dead bodies laying around in various stages of dissection. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, it was pretty ghoulish, but she had a strong stomach and didn't bother her. I would visit her on occasion and look around, and it was pretty gruesome to me. And at one point, somebody asked me if I would help them turn a body over. Grab the ankles, will you? You know, that kind of thing. And that was that. That pushed me to my limits. But there were all kinds of medical work being done on the corpses, human corpses, no question about that, that was for the benefit of others. Now, I suspect you probably, Matt, don't have a difficulty with using human corpses for medical experiments, in terms of the morality of it and the benefit
correct.
Okay, good. And I think that most people probably have that same intuition. Now, let me just ask you one other question that is really pivotal here. Does the way the human being died affect the moral equation with using that human being's corpse for medical purposes? So let's just say that my understanding is a lot of these bodies come from the morgue, okay? Unclaimed bodies, that happens. Let's just say 50% of the bodies in the tables there were the result of homicides. Does the fact that that human being dissected for medical purposes died as a result of a homicide make the dissection and the use of that educational moment for some other benefit, does it make that immoral?
No, it does not.
Okay, I agree with you. Now, my question is, morally speaking, not aesthetically now, but morally speaking, how is it different if the corpse is a fetal corpse? And there may be a difference here, and I'm open to hearing it, but you see where I'm going with this.
Yes, and I don't think there is a moral difference between an adult or a fetal corpse in that case. No.
Mm-hmm. Well, then maybe this is a quest. Maybe this is the way I put it to you and walked you through it about human necropsy mm-hmm. labs, etc. Maybe that's a series of questions that could be put to some of your friends. Now, if they're going to say, well, but this is different, well, then I think it's beholden upon them to identify what that difference is that matters in terms of the moral equation, all right?
Okay.
And I'm, like I said, I'm open to hearing it. I think largely what is going on here, though, is a kind of revulsion, understandably, that is not a moral revulsion, but an aesthetic revulsion in virtue of the moral harm of abortion proper. So I identify with this, I relate to it and everything, but if we're going to parse it out, I can see why people will say, hey, I'm not going to have anything to do with that because I don't want to get close to that thing. I don't want to get close to abortion, fetal tissue, etc. I can understand that, but that's not a moral point, really. I know that in the Joseph Mengele, you know, the butcher from Auschwitz or whatever they called him, the something, you know, the doctor there at Auschwitz who did these grotesque experiments that, among other things, dealt with hypothermia and basically freezing people and testing. Well, there were actually valuable results that came out of those grotesque studies. And now some people thought that no good should be made of those studies because of the circumstances under which they were conducted. And I understand a person's revulsion to that. But more in terms of the moral equation, I don't think it goes through. And why can't first of all, I don't see how using the medical using the tissue from an abortion or using the medical details from Joseph Mengele is itself immoral. And secondly, could you argue that at least something good comes from this poor infant's death? I think that's another aspect to it. I'm not real confident right now, Matt, that the friends that you talk to using this illustration are going to come around to your side. I can't guarantee that because the emotions run high in this. But I think there's a meaningful case that could be made. And if people don't buy it, I understand that. I'm going to say, all right, this doesn't make sense to you. Fine. You still think it's immoral. Fine. I understand that. But for them to say in reverse to me, no, I disagree with you and you're so wrong, I'm not even going to talk to you again. That seems to be over the top.
Yeah.
So.
And there's a whole gamut of name calling that comes from it too. You know, the whole shill, conspirator, you know, sheep, the whole nine yards. It's gotten, I think, to be a little too heavy-handed, I think.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, name-calling is never a good response in any argument, even if you're right, because ridicule is not an argument. Name-calling is not an argument. Putting people down is not an argument. It's not substantive, and nobody on our side should be resorting to that kind of thing. Oftentimes when that happens, it's because the other person's point of view is so weak that they have no alternative but to resort to that. Now, that's not always the case. It could also be that they have a strong case, but they're just so emotionally tied to it that they want to demonize whoever disagrees with them. And that's a different type of problem. That isn't a problem so much with the arguments that are weak, and so they have to do an ad hominem to shore them up. It's a problem in character that a person cannot countenance being disagreed with, and so he's got to demonize the one who gainsays his own point of view. So I don't know what's going on with the friends that you've talked to, but all righty.
Oh, sir, you've been such a big help. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, Matt. And I don't mean to suggest that this is an easy thing to resolve, but sometimes, you know, you got to ask other questions and parse it out a little bit, and maybe certain elements of it become more clear. All right?
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the call, Matt. And here I have something. Let me put my glasses on. The enforcer just gave me, so I'm not even sure what I'm in for here, but I hear Scott Klusen, I see Scott Klusendorf's name here, so let me, who is a dear friend of mine, maybe that he and I disagree on this. Let's see. I've been asked a question regarding the morality or not of vaccination in light of the fact that some vaccines made use of aborted fetal tissue in the course of their development. I ran my reply by a number of people before posting it. Of those that responded, Scott Klusendorf agreed with me. Well, that means I got to read. And here's what he says in his argument. From what I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the enforcer has indicated a couple of paragraphs that are relevant. What I've read, and I'm no expert, the use of aborted fetal tissue in vaccines goes back to just two babies from the 60s. That's an evil, but it's not an ongoing evil. It's not as if babies are currently being aborted to supply the raw material for vaccines, or so I read. And by the way, this is a significant piece of the moral equation. If children are being killed for the purpose of these things, and by participating in the use of the vaccine, you are encouraging such an industry Well, I think that changes things significantly. However, that doesn't seem to be the case here. And then here's another point that indicated on the piece that the enforcers pointed out for me. My point is that one can't reject a vaccination simply because the process by which it was produced was morally tainted at some point along the way. After all, even if the vaccine were not the result of aborted fetal tissue from long ago, medical science is populated by sinners like the rest of us, and there are sinful factors that invariably figure in to the process somewhere or another. So it looks like this particular post agrees with my view, and they said that Scott agrees with them, so that means Scott agrees with me on this as far as it goes, and it's always good when you're talking about a bioethical issue to have Scott Klusendorf in your corner on this. Like I said, I understand a sense of aesthetic revulsion that someone might feel when they have the knowledge that even if it were the case that tissue from aborted fetuses was somehow involved in the production of a vaccine that is bringing health and wholeness and even life to ensuring life for many others. I understand the revulsion, but the question here that has to be asked is there in fact a participation in, morally speaking, in the abortion because one is using something that resulted from the use of an aborted fetus? And there I don't see the connection. I just don't see the moral connection. And like I said, maybe I'm missing something and others can weigh in on that, or you could draw your own conclusions about it. But when you think about it, virtually there's nothing that you can be involved in, be party with, no product that you can use that doesn't have some connection with somebody's sin along the way. And if it's okay to use human cadavers for medical research, regardless of the way those human cadavers happen to face their demise, then it strikes me that it's okay then to benefit from vaccines, even if they are the result, one way or another, of the use of cadavers that come from unborn children who died through abortion. Weighty matters, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad we get a chance to talk about those here on Stand to Reason. That's it for this hour, though. I'm Greg Kokel. I've got more to come. Hope you stay with us. Hello, my friends. Welcome to the show. Greg Kokel here, your host. And the show is called Stand to Reason, where every week for 3 hours, I, metaphorically speaking, stand to reason. I'm actually seated here. Actually, there are a lot of radio talk show hosts that stand. I've been in studios that are standing studios, and usually this is the lively talk show environment, and the guys are jumping around, and they need room to move. I'm more of a sitter. I could do either way, actually. And I do stand for a lot of public presentations, sometimes all day long, and that's all right with me. But now I'm sitting, though in my mind I'm standing to reason for classical Christianity and for classical Christian values. This last week, there is a story that's hit the press that has gotten a lot of attention. And it's a sad story. And therefore, it has tremendous power to persuade people regarding the issue that is being championed in this story. And in fact, it is made more powerful because the advocate is a young, attractive, newly wed who is facing her imminent death due to cancer. Name's Brittany Maynard, married, just over a year. Now I think it's a little longer, but she was 29, and having been married just over a year, trying for a family, discovers that she has brain cancer, and that there's really no way to stop the growth of the tumor. And consequently, anticipating her imminent death, has decided to take matters into her own hands and die on her own schedule. Now, for all I know, at this point, today is the 28th of October. She's still alive, is that right? But she may not be for long, because she was going to wait at least until her husband's birthday, which is October 26th, and then take her life at according to her own timing. Let's put it that way. I think her expectation was to die soon after that, because she does not want to waste away in a hospice. She is not entirely confident that the drugs that are available, the palliative drugs, that is, drugs meant to minimize pain, will be adequate to take the pain away. And she is committed to the concept of death with dignity. Now, this is a euphemism that I hate, because it is a euphemism that distorts the truth. As if those who choose to weather it to the end and fight it out until nature takes its natural course, as if they are not dying with dignity. How is it that dignity dying with dignity depends on whether or not you're in pain? Listen, the world is filled with people in pain who can still, all kinds of pain, not just physical, emotional, but can still comport themselves with dignity. They can live in a dignified way, even though they don't choose to end it all right now. So in the euphemism, there is a kind of a put down in a certain sense, and this is not intended with the euphemism, I don't suggest that, but there is kind of a put down that if you choose to suffer, then there is something undignified about that. No, I think it can be ugly. I think it could be something that's almost impossible for people to stomach who are watching it. There are all kinds of, in a certain sense, appropriate ways to describe the ugliness of it. Disease, pain, suffering. But the word dignity is not, it seems to me, the right word to be used in this circumstance, such that if you're suffering, that's somehow undignified. And the dignified way to die is to take your own life. And this is the other part of the euphemism that troubles me, is it's a euphemism for suicide. Now, in Brittany Maynard's defense, she says she is not suicidal. And when I say in her defense, I mean I have to tell you that she said that, but this doesn't make sense to me. Because arranging with a doctor to receive a medication, which she's already done, in order to take the medication to end your life, it seems to me suicide is a word that is properly applied there. Now, I understand suicide can be done in different ways, and she said, I already have plenty of pills. I could take them now. All right. No, I think she is suicidal. She is just calmly suicidal. And what this approach, this euphemism does is it dignifies suicide. No, what's wrong with suicide? I mean, after all, and this is what the headline reads here, My Right to Death with Dignity at 29. You might have seen the picture of this young lady, Brittany Maynard, on the cover of People magazine. I saw it in the airport last week. Didn't read the article. I glanced quickly at it, but then I got this missive from my office, and I asked, is this the same gal in People? And she said, and they said, yes, it is. So here you have it. And My Right to Death with Dignity. Now, what I want to point out here at this point is that there are worldview considerations that are in play. And though I think people in the West especially, in America for sure, really resonate with this, my right to do what I want with my own body, I think it's fair for, it would be healthy for us to at least ask some foundational questions about this. What makes you think that you have a right to what happens to your own body? Now, I realize, gosh, a lot of people are hear that and are dumbstruck. Isn't it obvious? And I said, well, my point here is let's parse this out a little bit. What gives you the right to your own life? Now, remember, a right is a just claim to something. That means you have a claim that is appropriate, that is morally justified. All right? I gave a talk quite a number of years ago now to the Christian Legal Society at the University of Southern California, USC. And the talk I gave was the late 90s, was on relativism. And there was a young lady studying at law at USC who came up to me afterwards, and she said, I am an atheist and an animal rights activist. And I said to her, I think you're going to have a difficult time making sense of the phrase that you just offered me. And she said, why? I think animals have a right not to suffer. And I said, and I think I have a right to half of your income for my organization. And then I said, tell me what the difference is between our two claims. You made an assertion. I made an assertion. What What makes your claim any more legitimate than my claim on your worldview, which is the point? If you're an atheist, and this is especially true if you are a materialistic atheist, that is, you're an Enlightenment kind of atheist, like most of the new atheists and those following them that think that the material world is all there is. We're just molecules clashing in the universe, and the natural order is run by natural law, and there is no mind involved at all. In that kind of world, a world without mind, without intention, without ultimate purpose, where does one get the idea that anyone or anything has a right to anything at all? Well, you can't do it. You can claim it, but a rights claim are just claims to things, that is, morally just, morally appropriate claims. They are not just claims, all right? They're not merely claims. They are morally appropriate claims. That's what rights amount to. And in a universe where there is no, well, certainly no God to underscore or undergird moral claims in general, and in a universe where there is nothing immaterial that exists anyway, how are you going to get the moral obligation of an immaterial, abstract right of any kind? So the point I'm making here is for someone to advance rights language is to make, if the claim that is being advanced is coherent, to be coherent, it is to affirm a certain kind of world. It's a world where immaterial moral obligations exist, and this is one of them. This right. And in order to make sense out of this right for those moral obligations, and I've argued this elsewhere, I won't here, I'll just assert it, you're going to have a moral lawmaker that underscores or undergirds or underwrites the moral laws you're making an appeal to implicitly with your rights claim. So when somebody writes an article, "My right to death with dignity at 29, I ask the question, what makes you think you have any rights at all? Certainly a right, in particular, a right to choose the time of death. You could only have rights in a moral universe governed by God, who gives those rights uniquely to human beings. And that's the way our founders argued. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that each is endowed by his creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness." Curiously, by the way, it doesn't say right to death, but right to life. And someone might want to press the word happiness there. Well, they didn't mean happiness the way you probably mean it. They meant the good life, the rich life, the full life, the life being lived as it ought to be lived as a human being. And that isn't a life that pursues one's own death. So if you have a right to life, it's only because God has given you that right to life. And then the question becomes, in God's eyes, is it legitimate for one to deprive themselves of their own right to life? Now, last time I read the Ten Commandments, it said, "Thou shalt not murder." That is, it is wrong to take a life without proper justification. Well, what is it that makes that wrong? In biblical terms, it's because human beings are made really special. Of course, we already know this without the Bible, but the Bible tells us what it is that makes us special, and that is we bear God's mark. And that's why in Genesis 9, verse 6, it says, "Whoever takes man's life, by man his life shall be taken, for in the image of God, God created man." That is, human life is so special that if you destroy a human life, then you sacrifice your life as a result. Now, here's what's curious. It doesn't make the distinction between taking another life and taking one's own life. It simply points out that human life ought not be taken because human life bears God's image. And when you take a life, you destroy an image bearer. And that's true even if you take your own life. I have no idea what it must be like to suffer physically in profound ways, because that's not happened to me. I've never been sick like that. I do not look forward to anything like that. I never want to feel that kind of thing. Emotional pain, yes, but everybody's experienced that. Physical pain, I think I was thinking about this when I was doing a workout the other day, and I think that emotional pain is the better choice. Physical pain, I've had a couple of leg cramps lately. Those really hurt. Emotional pain can be really bad, but if those leg cramps are just kind of touching the surface of what human pain could amount to, and I suspect that's the case. My pastor was in such pain with an ailment he had that he wanted to die. He said, I wanted to die. It was that I would have taken death rather than suffer that pain. So physical pain can really be bad. I understand that. And I don't want to sound like I'm not sympathetic to that, such that when a person suffers really terrible physical pain, it is completely understandable they'd want to take their own life. The question isn't whether we can understand that. The question is whether it's right for them to do that and whether we should champion such a thing. And additionally, though this is not my topic right now, are there further ramifications of such choices in society at large? And all you have to do is go to Europe and you can see what happens to innocent people who don't want to die when so-called death with dignity statutes are in place for a long time. All of a sudden, people who wanted to stick around for a while, I'm not dead yet. I'm getting better, as Monty Python would say. They end up losing their lives too because something changes in a culture and the way they view human life when these kinds of things become popular, and when, not even popular, when these things are justified in the law. It says that it is not human life that is really the ultimate valuable thing. It is not the human, but rather a quality of life. And this even pops up in this article here. Do we want to say that? That's a whole other issue. I'm simply making the point there are worldview considerations here. If there is no God, you don't have a right to anything. You can get away with certain things. You might have the power to accomplish things. But let's be clear on what's going on there. That's a power deal. That's not a rights deal. If you do have rights of any kind, well, you've got to make sense, or you got to offer a worldview in which any rights claims can get some traction, can make sense. I think there are human rights. I think it's obvious that there are human rights. I don't think there's an obvious human right to die. And I don't think taking your own life is death with dignity. It's undignified to kill yourself. It's an immoral way to go. But the other side has hijacked the terminology here. But in any event, if there is no God, then you don't have rights. And if you do have rights, there's got to be a God. And maybe this God has something to say about the limits of those rights. Maybe it isn't your life at all. Maybe you owe something to God. Maybe you owe something to your community. Now, I know this dear woman, Brittany Maynard, has purposed to die in such a way that she can say goodbye to her community. And this is her last paragraph. When my suffering becomes too great, I can say to all those I love you. Come be by my side. Come say goodbye as I pass into whatever's next. And she says, I will die upstairs in my bedroom with my husband, mother, stepfather, best friend by my side and pass peacefully. I can't imagine trying to rob anyone else of that choice. Now, why? Let me back up and put it this way. There are legions of people that die just that way without dying at their own hand. They are at the end of their life. They say they pass with those who they love all around them. They say their goodbyes and they move on to the next life. Maybe not as peacefully as chemical suicide would allow, but chemical suicide is not dignified. It's just suicide. It's quiet, painless, hardly dignified. There's one other little detail, though, and that is I come to say goodbye as I pass into whatever's next. You realize that when people exercise this legal liberty now in 5 states of doctor-assisted suicide, their intention is to end the suffering. That also has worldview considerations. You realize, of course, that it, regardless of what side of the theological divide you find yourself, that it's certainly possible that the suffering for many people does not end at death, but it increases at death. Because if, in fact, there is a God who judges our lives in some fashion and finds us wanting, again, regardless of how you cash this out theologically, if there is a judgment, it may be that many people who end their physical suffering in this life pass on to a greater suffering in the next. Is that possible? I actually think it's likely. That's why I'm a Christian. But if you're not sure, at least it's possible. And so everybody is making worldview assumptions in this particular discussion, not just me talking about God and rights. Everybody is making an assumption. All right, time for a break. You're listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel.
Stand to Reason's new Quick Reference app is now available for free on Apple, Android, and Windows mobile devices. The STR Quick Reference app summarizes the information you need to know about tactics, abortion, and other relevant topics through text and video, equipping you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the most important issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Download the STR Quick Reference app today and be prepared to respond with knowledge, wisdom, and character everywhere you go.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason's the show. And let's see, we've got Jason in Maui who's back with us. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Okay, we've talked before, haven't we?
We've talked a couple times before. Yeah.
Well, good to have you back on board.
No, it was. It's good to be with you again. And during my time waiting, I'm in the process of downloading that STR Quick Reference app. So,
good for you.
Right on.
Okay,
yeah,
good. By the way, it's 5:30 here, roughly. What time is it now in Maui?
Yeah, it's got to be around. It's around 2:30 here.
Okay, so you got a 3-hour time. It's just like East Coast to here. From there, it's 3 hours away. And I might have asked you this before, but do you know my friend Craig Englert and the whole crowd there at Hope Chapel Kihei?
I very much do. Yeah, in fact, I'm very involved at that very church.
That's great.
Craig.
Well, that's
yeah.
Well, you know, Craig and I go back to actually Craig and I met before my first spiritual birthday. I think I was about 8 months old or 6 months old in the Lord when we met. And he was my first discipler, and he saved my life, Craig Englert. I mean, spiritually speaking, I don't know where I'd be if it weren't for Craig and Kathy Englert in my life at that particular time, because I was one wild and crazy guy. And they
right, and I believe you referred to it as most of the time it was him putting his foot in your back.
Yeah, well, in my pants. He had to do that a lot, but he just, you know, Craig, he's got a touch, you know, and you never doubt that he loves you, and that was real important to me. So
definitely.
I was willing to take the discipline as it came.
Excellent. Well, I got a couple of questions. Melissa actually encouraged me to give you an update on kind of some things we had talked about in the past.
All right.
So if there's time, I will get to that.
Okay.
But my question today is about William Lane Craig. I know that you're good friends with him,
mm-hmm.
and I guess to preface it, you know, my question in no way kind of casts any doubt on whether or not he loves the Lord. I think that's quite obvious to me that he
absolutely
has a really vibrant relationship with Jesus.
I think that's true.
So, I do too. But, you know, I just find it curious that many times in the debates that he engages in, he will make a point at some point in the debate to kind of specifically state, hey, I'm not up here as a Christian. I'm not defending the Christian God. I'm defending more a broader view of theism that I believe he says is in line with, you know, forms of Judaism and Islam and deism. And I guess I just wonder, that always kind of stands out to me when I hear that. Just wondering about the merits of that, and are we being faithful to Christ when we're standing up there representing him to an audience that maybe doesn't believe in him, to an opponent
right.
who doesn't believe in him,
right.
you know, and then we make it a point to say, hey, I'm not there specifically, I'm just there in a general way. I'm just curious about the merits of that.
And yeah.
Like I told Melinda, I know he's too smart of a guy to not have a good reason for doing it that
right.
way. So
uh-huh.
I don't question, you know, why he's doing it. I just wonder about the merits, I guess.
Yes,
and,
okay.
Maybe
well,
you could weigh in on that.
Yeah, of course I'd be glad to, in defense of my dear friend and brother in Christ,
right.
William Lane Craig. And I know exactly what's going on in these circumstances, and this has been raised regarding him before. In fact, I've heard him respond to this very issue. So I know what's going on. When a Christian is in a debate, the Christian's goal is to make a strategic contribution to the discussion by defending a particular point. When I debate, for example, on the issue of relativism, my point is to show that moral relativism is false and some form of moral objectivism is true. Now, when in the book that Dr. Beckwith and I did on the topic of relativism, I wrote the beginning and I wrote the end. So I make the case not just against moral relativism, but in favor of the existence of God based on the failure of moral relativism and therefore the fact of some kind of moral objectivism or moral realism. So in that work, I take the next step and I make the case for God, basically the moral argument for the existence of God. Now, nowhere in that book do we talk about Jesus or the cross or the resurrection or faith in Christ or anything. We have a very narrow purpose. I do talk about God, but even when I'm debating against relativism proper, I don't even necessarily make the moral argument for the existence of God. I realize that strategically that's a different issue. And for the purposes of that event that afternoon or evening, I do not want to get sidetracked from a very important point that I want to defend. So if somebody in a debate with me on the issue of moral relativism, where I have a goal to make a certain point that I think fits strategically into the larger Christian worldview and the larger case for Christianity, I do not want them dragging me off on a discussion on the substitutionary atonement, because this isn't the point I'm there to make. And if I get dragged off of the point I want to make, chances are pretty good I'm not going to be able to make any point very effectively. And this happens with Bill many times in his debates with atheists when the debate is the existence of God proper. Many times he is going to address simply that question and not get dragged off into questions about the Bible, about doctrinal or theological issues, or even questions about atonement and Christ, because then he will not be able to accomplish the task that he is there to do. It is not that he's not interested in talking about those things, but rather that he is trying to, and in this point, tactically deal with an illicit debate tactic of his opponents to get him off the topic so he can't make the case for the existence of God because he's chasing red herrings on other issues. And this is where I think he's been pretty aggressive in saying, I'm not going there. It isn't because he's afraid of the issue or he doesn't care about the gospel. The gospel has ultimate significance for Bill Craig. In any given exchange, though, he is strategically thinking about the best impact that he can make in that circumstance for the longer-term case of the gospel, and therefore he's going to limit his comments. But he doesn't always do it that way. I was at his debate with Christopher Hitchens, and as I recall, he not only made the case for the existence of God, but also as part of that. Part of his case for the existence of God is the person of Jesus of Nazareth and the resurrection of Christ. Because if Jesus rose from the dead and Jesus claimed to be God, that's evidence that he is God, so that's evidence for God.
Right.
And so even in his general debates about the existence of God, he will often, as a strategic concern, incorporate the gospel and Christ and the resurrection into that.
Right, and I definitely agree. I think, and I do think that we should, in love, you know, call people on when they're trying to distract us and, you know, drag us down other kind of secondary rabbit trails, like you said.
Right.
I guess I don't know if it's just an issue of here's my cards on the table, you know. So I'm coming from a place of I'm a believer in Jesus Christ, and so my worldview is then shaped by it. You often say that you know, I'm a Christian because I believe that Jesus got it right about the world. That's my worldview. And so from there, that's going to inform my answers to these questions, you know. And I just wonder, you could still do that without being distracted. I think that's a different kind of issue.
Not quite when the clock is ticking.
Yeah, no, that was what I was about to say next. And having said that, you know, in a debate format where you don't really know what's going on and you have a limited time.
Well, and also, you know, even thinking about the pro-life issue, for example, if I'm talking with somebody about the pro-life issue, okay, and they say, well, you know, the Bible's filled with contradictions. That's why you can't trust it. And I'm going to say, I'm not making a case from the Bible. I'm here to defend that unborn child. And I am not bringing the Bible into the discussion. Does that mean that I, as a Christian, holding to a Christian worldview and Jesus got reality right, don't believe in the Bible? Of course I do, but I realize what's going on. This is a distractive element. Now, if somebody wants to talk about that, I'll talk about it, but I'm not going to let that be a red herring in the discussion that I think we're having at the moment.
Right. No, I totally agree with you there. I'd ask that person what's wrong with contradictions, you know, because they're putting their worldview forward. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, that's another angle you could go in that direction. But regardless, even when it comes to the scripture, I don't want to chase the contradiction challenge with non-Christians, because contradictions are only relevant to the broader question of the inerrancy of scripture. But that's, in my view, this is an in-house discussion, Jason. So you and I can talk about inerrancy, fine. But because we both acknowledge the, in some sense, the authority of the Bible, and therefore theoretically now, you and I may have differences about how far that authority extends, but that's an in-house discussion. If you are a non-Christian, Jason, I'm not going to discuss family business with you, because I don't have to defend inerrancy to make my case for Christianity. Whether or not the Bible has contradictions is a red herring to that larger discussion, the more important discussion regarding the legitimacy of God or Christianity or whatever. And so, you know, contradictions are irrelevant to my case.
Yeah, with that, I would 100% agree with you. Yeah. And I think, all too often when that kind of challenge is put out, too many Christians will, you know, bite that and go for that and try and show all these reasons why it's not contradictory. And that won't really advance the discussion. Yeah. But I agree with you.
Yeah, by the way, if somebody's claiming that Christian theology is contradictory and therefore Christianity itself is undermined, that's a little bit different. But these are alleged Bible contradictions, verses that clash with each other, and that's a whole different thing. And I think it's fair to say, with that kind of challenge, when somebody says, well, what about all the contradictions in the Bible? Well, what about them? Well, the Bible contradicts. And why is that? And why is that relevant to our discussion? Well, if the Bible, then it's not God's word. But I'm not arguing with you that it's God's word, am I?
Right.
I haven't raised that issue at all. And since I'm not putting the Bible is God's inerrant word on the table, then any of your arguments against that are missing the mark entirely.
And I think that that individual, in saying there's contradictions, is assuming a standard of truth and falseness that then the Bible falls under.
Yeah.
And I wonder where they're getting that from as well.
Yeah, well, it could be, they could be arguing kind of the, I think what they're ultimately going towards is the idea that truth, that if God is God and he inspired the Bible, then he can't contradict himself, but there are contradictions, therefore the Bible isn't God's word. And I think that's a reasonable challenge. It's just irrelevant to the point that I would be making with a non-Christian at that point, because I am not arguing for the Bible as the inspired word of God. If I'm making my case, I look at the early church didn't have an inspired New Testament. What do they have? They have a testimony of the person of Jesus who was crucified, died, buried, rose again. And this is a case that can be made regardless of the inerrancy or lack thereof of Scripture. It's a separate issue. And okay.
Right.
Well, bring me up to date, because, we're at a break right now. So let's just take a moment and go to break, and I'll keep you on, Jason, and I'll come back. I'm not going to push any buttons, so you might not hear anything except for my voice coming on in 2 minutes, and we'll revisit the other issue that we talked about last time and get an update, okay? All right, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-5 4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and stand to reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right, back at you here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here, one of the good guys, equipping you to think. Every Tuesday night, every week, I should say. Now, I used to say every weekend, but we're not on live on the weekends anymore. Many of you are listening on Sunday. But the live broadcast is on Tuesday nights from 4 until 7. So 3 hours every week, as I like to say, when I'm out of town. It's just 3 hours. That's just one L.A. commute, so it's not burdensome. And it's there for you. So if you're only catching an hour on the weekend or whatever, just be sure and get the podcast, and you'll get the entire thing. Let's go back to Jason. You still with me, Jace?
I'm still here, Greg.
Okay, and Jason's in Maui, and it's the middle of the afternoon. And tell me, we talked once before, I think, about your brother-in-law, same-sex marriage. So why don't you, let's bring us up to date on what we talked, and for me and the audience, and then give us an update.
Right. Well, the last time we talked, my wife and I were trying to navigate what we were going to do about whether or not we would attend the ceremony of my brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. He was planning to get married.
And this is your wife's brother, right?
My wife's brother,
okay.
Yeah. So he has since gotten married, and after a lot of prayer and counsel, just praying through it, you know, crying through it, my wife decided to go to be with him, to support him. We were both in agreement about where we stood on it, but she had felt led to go and be there, and I had felt that I couldn't do that in my heart.
I'm a little confused. I need some clarification on the language "felt led," but also on the language of "to support him," and "to support him" means what, and "to be felt led to do that" means what.
Right, right, and I know that's right. It's my mistake. I shouldn't have used
those. No, I'm not trying to find fault. I'm just clarification. That's
right. I guess praying through it and coming to the conviction that she could be there as his sister for this event without also endorsing the. This union,
okay.
And I know she, you know, she's not with me, so I don't want to put words in her mouth.
Yes,
or whatever.
I'm actually much more comfortable with the way you put it just then, and that partly because it helps me understand more clearly what you meant by those words. Okay, so thank you for clarifying.
No, thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify. That's helpful.
So was that hard for you, or did you feel comfortable that you both kind of came to a little different place on the propriety of being at the event?
Right, and I like what you just said there, because that is the issue of being at the event. As far as our hearts are concerned on this issue, where our hearts and minds are, it's lining up right where the scriptures are. And so, you know, she had actually communicated that to her brother through a phone conversation, and he had told her that he understood that.
Wow.
He had said, I understand that you're not in agreement and that you feel this way, but I still would just like you there as my sister.
Huh.
So that, with that...
you know, that's a very, in my experience, that is a very rare response.
That, I know.
Yes, that goodwill is extended regarding the conscience concern. Goodwill extended from the homosexual side regarding the conscience concern.
Right, and that is very much to his credit, because
yes,
I
agree
that as well. Yeah,
I agree.
So,
I tip my hat to him for that.
Well, then it might be more tipping, because that's kind of my question. So he has extended to us an invitation for this Christmas to spend Christmas with him, and he's offered to pay for both my wife and I to fly up and be with him and his partner up in the mainland where he lives.
Incidentally, so, I'm glad you called him his partner, and I know you're kind of stuck with marriage language, but I'm just wondering if maybe we can start just referring to it as a union.
Yes.
They had a union, so, and they have a union because I think same-sex marriage is an oxymoron, but I'm not going to fuss about that, but I'm just toying with the idea. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to slap your hands or anything. But
Right. Well, I know that I read a blog by Douglas Wilson the other day where he'd like to start referring to it as a same-sex mirage. Instead of same-sex marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. So well, there might be a point there, but it is a little bit bellicose.
Right. No,
it's
I would
kind
agree.
Of a poke in the eye. Agree. Okay.
Yeah, but...
I have a lot of respect for Doug Wilson. I don't know him, but he's made a significant contribution, including he started the whole school system that my children's school belongs to. So I...
Right.
So that's good. But that might be a little bit too aggressive.
Quite the wordsmith. Mr. Wilson.
Yes,
but
yes.
We're planning to, you know, accept that generosity and go and spend Christmas with them. And I guess with that, I guess two things, just pray that the Lord would give us opportunities to share. But two, just any thoughts or ways that I could be tactful in kind of bringing things up and having conversations and
do you have children?
No, we don't.
Okay, well, good. That doesn't enter in, thankfully. But the question I have at this point, and the discussion you and I are having is an important one, and it's going to be a discussion that more and more Christians who care about this issue and being faithful to Christ are going to have, because we are going to be more and more forced into these circumstances where we're confronted with decisions we have to make regarding this issue. And since, what, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago when the Supreme Court pushed this whole issue, I think, completely irresponsibly back on the states, this means that this is a fait accompli as far as I'm concerned. It's over with. The Supreme Court is essentially taking the coward's way out to affirm the legitimacy of same-sex marriage, because in half of the states of the union now, you have same-sex marriage statutes.
Including my own.
Well, yeah. And most not consistent with the will of the people, but as a judicial
too.
Fiat, you know. But in any event, this is the case. So if the Supreme Court says we're not going to judge this now and gives a green light, a de facto green light to all of these states that already have it, listen, this thing is not going backwards. This just means, especially given that encouragement, that more judges or legislatures are going to pass laws legitimizing this thing. So the next time it comes around to the Supreme Court and we have 40 to 45 states with active legislation supporting same-sex marriage, do you think they're going to judge to overturn all of that stuff?
Yeah.
No way.
Not a chance.
No. Yeah. And so this is why I think this was the coward's way out by the Supreme Court. I think it really frustrates me. So this issue does not get its legitimate day in court. And the people who have made all of these state constitutional amendments do not get their legitimate day in court. Instead, they become victims of the of leftist activists, jurists and legislators. And I think that's tragic. But be that as it may, this is what we're faced with. So now the question is, where do you and I go from here? And with this issue that you've just raised about your brother-in-law and his partner, here's the question that I ask. How is the issue of spending Christmas with, and let me just use this word with scare quotes around it, with his family any different than the question you faced about going to the ceremony which legally legitimized the union?
Right.
You get my question?
No, I do. I do. I suppose in looking at the scriptures and how Jesus conducted himself in these matters, I think I'm of the conviction that accepting hospitality from non-believers or mm-hmm. people that hold a different view than you,
yes,
is exactly the kind of thing that Jesus would do on several occasions. Mm-hmm. You know, that he'd be at feasts and meals,
yeah.
And you know that understanding of meals too is just not a meal.
Right.
That was an extended social, you know, statement that he was
correct.
Making. That's why the Pharisees got so upset because, you know,
well,
of
let,
what
let
they
me,
understood.
Yeah. Okay. Let me offer a difference that might or may not be relevant here. I think that's a good response. I want to chew on it because this is something that I'm working through too. But accepting hospitality, okay. Okay. Now Jesus accepted hospitality from sinners. So
right.
He was willing to dine with sinners. So the question here isn't whether you or not you should dine with sinners, because even if they weren't joined in this union, they would still be sinners, you know, not homosexual sinners, some other kind of sinners. So that's not an issue as far as I'm concerned. The question here, and it goes back to the issue of the original union, public union, is
right.
there not an implicit affirmation of this family unit by participating in this familial way with them and treating as normal and as appropriate something that isn't.
Right.
So, I mean, that's
right.
the question. And again, what I just thought to myself, what if the woman at the well who had had five husbands and now is living with a man who isn't her husband, what if she would have invited Jesus over as a pure act of hospitality, not out of any spiritual interest?
Right.
I wonder, and I don't know one way or another. I'm not saying I know, but I'm wondering if Jesus would go and participate and spend the time in that house where a man and a woman are living together conjugally, but immorally. And so would he do that when there was no spiritual interest? The others invited him over because they had spiritual interest, and he was willing to dine with sinners to communicate spiritual truth, but I don't know, you know, it seems to me that he probably would have. I mean, that would be my impulse at this point, which means that maybe your decision is more defensible in light of that. I don't know.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, Greg, and that's something that, you know, I'd have to parse out as to why I have a clearer stance on this particular thing than I did with the wedding,
uh-huh.
or maybe I should state that a little differently. As
the union,
the
ceremony
the
is
union.
What I said earlier.
I viewed the ceremony and the union mm-hmm. as a much more clear-cut issue. That mm-hmm. wasn't for me to come to the conviction that I did was, and your teachings on it and your words have been very helpful in that. What do you
Thank
do
you.
When you go to a wedding?
You
in
celebrate,
general?
Right.
Right, exactly. And so that line of thinking was very helpful as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what do I do when I'm going to my brother-in-law's house and an event like Christmas also happens mm-hmm. to be, you know, at that same time? Well, I'm going there for fellowship. I'm mm-hmm. going there for hospitality.
You're not going there to celebrate their union. There's something.
Right.
The statement
of me being there.
That
yeah,
is a fair
is not,
distinction.
I affirm this.
I think that's a fair distinction. So this helps me, even as we're kind of knocking this around a little bit. I think it's a fair distinction. I'm thinking of a conversation I had with someone else that apparently got a little play in the blogosphere, I don't know, or I saw some comments. I don't usually read this kind of stuff because then it just annoys me. I don't want to get defensive. But somebody was uptight because I said it's not an act of intolerance if I don't let my children go play with another child who has a same-sex a couple who are the child's parents. And
right.
I'd want to protect my child, but it's not because I think my child is going to get corrupted somehow in the environment. It's that my girls are 9 and 6. They are sexually naive. I do not want to put them in a circumstance where they're saying, wait a minute, what's this all about? You know, and a guy with a guy, woman with a woman. I mean, what's up with that? Mm-hmm. I do not want to introduce them to those concepts until they're ready. And so this is one reason I asked about whether you had children. That would be an additional consideration, taking my 9 and my 6 into an environment like that, which is going to seem odd to them. And it's going to cause them to ask questions that I don't think they're developmentally, emotionally, whatever, ready to hear the answers regarding. That to me is another consideration. But what you've shared so far, I think, is really good and helps inform me about these kinds of things in the future. And there's going to be lots and lots of these circumstances come the future.
Right, right. And, you know, I think as far as your comments, I remember that show. Greg, I think anybody who was listening to you in context would not have misconstrued your words at all.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Intolerance. I certainly didn't. Yeah, I did. But if you lift your words out of your context, well, then you could make it mean anything.
Yeah,
want,
I guess this,
right?
this person just didn't trust my integrity when I said I'm really looking after my children. It's not a matter of intolerance. And it was kind of like, yeah, right, that is intolerance. But I suspect this person doesn't know what the word intolerance actually means, what its appropriate application is. Not trying to put them down, but there is a lot of confusion about that, about the meaning of that word. Look, all done here for the hour, Jason. It was great talking to you. Say hi to my friends out there at Hope Chapel in Kihei, okay?
Thank you so much, Greg, and always appreciate your ministry.
Okay, thanks so much. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week, my friends. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.